Okay, you would know. I wouldn't know.
So Rav Moshe, we're on Daf Tes Vav Amud Aleph to start a new week. And we really are up to the new part of the Mishnah, which is Dinei Nefashos, which I guess is about, I would say, 15 lines up from the bottom or so. But let's just finish up. There was one little piece that we didn't get a chance to finish on Thursday. And that you'll see, the previous two dots, where it says, V'odom kayotze bahen. And the first word of the line is kayotze.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You have that?
Yeah.
Okay.
The middle comment.
So that's about smack in the middle of the page. It's a little below Tosis Ein. And before Tosis Ba'anovim. And the Gemara raises the following question. We have a principle in Shas. It has really two names. They're synonymous. One is Omed and one is Ra'ui. Omed is a little bit even more profound than Ro'i. Ro'i means something that is in potential, but Omed means you're about to do something. You haven't done it yet, but all the pieces of the puzzle have fit into place. And whenever you see the word Omed, the Gemara wants to know, and this is always going to be an issue, debated back and forth by the Tanoim, the Amoraim, as to whether or not, since it's Omed, you view it halachically as if it was done already. Now, this becomes very relevant in our sugya with regard to the categorization of metaltalin versus karka. Because the Mishnah establishes that with regard to shuma, which means when the bezin has to evaluate an object that was consecrated as a hegdesh, in order that the pidgin would be accurate, so you have to know if he was magdish X, let's say it was Magdish Behema, let's say. Table's a little easier because the Behema could sometimes be Kochi Aguf, which doesn't lend itself to Pidgin. But let's say a table. So now he wants to be pulled to the table from Hegdesh, get back his table. So we have to evaluate exactly how much the table's worth. The Mishnah says we need a tribunal of three. According to one sheet that's from Yehuda, one of the three has to be a Kohen. But that was last sugya that we covered last week. Whereas if he was Magdish Karka, and then he wants to be Po de Karka to evaluate real estate, we need a tribunal of 10 people. Right, Mitch? We said the tribunal could even be of 10. That's Mitch did some research for me. So now the question is, what about Omed? You have something that is, at this point, either Karka or Metaltalin, but it's about to be cut down. Meaning you have something that is attached to Karka, but it's about to be detached. And all the pieces of the puzzle are ready for that. So that's called, in the Lashon of Rabbi Ovin, if you see here, Seyar Ha'omed Ligzos. He was actually Magdish Seyar. Seyar means hair. Hair is that one part of the body that really doesn't function within the context of the organism, but if it's attached to the body, then it has the same status as the goof. Now, assuming this goof is karka. Now, why would this goof be karka? So that was the last sugi that we did, which you'll see one line above, and that's called Eved Iskish LeKarka. Right? We have a hekesh between Eved and karka, which means that a human body is considered like karka. So, for example, if I demand from you to return two avodim of mine, and you admit that you are holding on to one Eved, but you deny the other Eved. So that's normally modu mixa tani have to take a shvua, but we have a principle called Eid Nishman ala karkos. You don't take a shvua on real estate, and an Eved has the same status as real estate. So now the Gemara wants to know what happens in the case of Seyar Ha'omeg Ligzos. He wants to do a pidgin on the Seyar. Again, maybe the Seyar is worth something on the market to make a wig out of it, or whatever you say, maybe they use it to make a broom, I don't know. And the Gemara wants to know, how many people do we need on the board, on the panel, to evaluate its value? Do we need three because it's metaltalin? Or do we need 10 because it's karka? It's still attached to the body. And insofar as it's attached to the body, it has the status of what? Karka. Everybody see that? Because Eved Hukash le karka. But on the other hand, it's Omed Ligzos. You're about to cut it off. You know, it's kind of like the case of a person who he really badly needs a haircut, so he just hasn't gotten to the barber yet. But as soon as he gets to the barber, they can cut off his hair. So how does halacha view this? We have a principle called omed, and we say that here it's omed. Everything is ready. We're just about to cut off the hair. Do we view it as metaltalin or do we view it as karka? So the Gemara says the following: Ki gazuz domi ubishlosha. It's as if it's cut off the eved. And therefore it has the status of metaltolin, and all we need is a panel of three. Oh, or shall we say, kimechuber dummy, it's still right now in its present state attached to the goof. And therefore it has the din of an eved hukash lekarka, and karka requires asara, we need a full panel of ten experts in order to evaluate the karka. So again, if we say it's karka, then the halacha is you require asara. If we say it's omed ligzos kigazos domi, it's as if it was cut off already, then it has the status of a talit. All we need is a tribunal of how many?
Three.
Toshma. This is where we got up to on Yom Chamishi. So it says the following. The Braisa records a sheet of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Hamagdish es avdo. He designated his eved as hegdesh. Now, normally in the case of Hegdesh, if you enjoy the benefit of that Hegdesh without a pigeon, without redeeming it, then you're chayev as a moel behegdesh. That's the chayev me'ila. There's a whole Masechet in Shas dedicated to the laws of me'ila. So now he uses the Eved after he was magdish the Eved. So the Tanakhama says, ein moel imbo. And the Gemara understands that if the Tanakhama says this in an unqualified way, it means in all cases there's no me'ila. No matter what he does with the Eved, let's say for example, in this case that we're dealing with, he has some benefit from the Seir of the Eved, from the hair of the Eved. Without doing a pigeon, he enjoys the benefit, he takes his personal benefit from the Seir. Since the Chachamim didn't qualify that statement, they said ein mo'el imbo, because we have a principle called eved hukash lekarka. We said eved hukash lekarka means that you don't take a shvu on an eved. So too, there's no me'ila on an eved, because me'ila only applies to metaltalin, and it doesn't apply to karka. Anything that has a shame karka, it's defined as karka, is excluded from me'ila. So the Chachamim say that the eved, in his entirety, including his hair, is hukash lekarka, is a din of karka, and therefore there's no me'ila. Rav Shimon Gamliel omer molim b'sa'aro. Even though you're right, there's no me'ila vis-a-vis the gufa eved, because the gufa eved is hukash lekarka, that's the same karka, and there's no me'ila on karka, but the se'ar, the hair of the eved, is considered metaltalin. If it's metaltalin, then it will be me'ila on the se'ar of the eved. That's the sheet of Rav Shimon Gamliel. The Kaimalon. Kaimalon means we have a tradition that what is the nature, what is the case which Rav Shimon Gamliel addresses? It's Beseir HaOmed Ligzos. And on that we have Pligi, we have Machlokas. In other words, Rav Shimon Gamliel takes the position that since this Seir is about to be cut off, it's already considered cut, it's detached from the body, it no longer has the status of Eved, and it's no longer karka, but rather it's viewed as movable object. That means it's metaltalin, and therefore the seir pligi. But the chachamim disagree. They made an absolute statement, unqualified, that even vis-a-vis the seir of the eved, there's no me'ila, because the eved, including his seir, is karka, and there's no me'ila in karka. So the Gemara thinks that the answer to Rabbi Ovin's question, remember that Rabbi Ovin vacillated as far as the status of seir omid ligzos, is it metaltalin, is it karka? It depends on the machlokas between the Chacham and Rav Shimon Gamliel. So in other words, what Rabbi Ovin was confused about was way earlier than Rabbi Ovin, a subject of a debate between the Chachamim and Rav Shimon Gamliel, where the Chachamim said that it's still mechuber lekarka, still mechuber to the Eved, the Seir has not been cut off yet, hence it has a din of karka, and there's no me'ila. Rav Shimon Gamliel on the other hand says, you're about to cut off the Seir, it has a din of metaltalin, as if it was already cut out. Shmami, no, the Gemara says, I accept that there's no doubt the issue of how many people you need to form a panel to evaluate for purpose of pigeon hegdesh, the seir of a person, and the seir of an eved, or the seir of a human being. That machlokas, whether you need three because it's metaltalin or ten because it's karka, is totally dependent upon the machlokas between Chachamim Rav Shimon Gamliel regarding the law of Me'ila on Seir HaOmed Ligzos. Is it considered Kigaz's dummy, hence it's Metalton, there is Me'ila, and that's Rav Shimon Gamliel? Or do we accept the Chacham, it's still attached to the body, it still has the status of an Eved, Hukash Lekarka, and therefore there's no Me'ila. So we have two debates, and they're interdependent. What we call in the Gemara's language, Haba Talia. If you want to know what is the ultimate status of Seir HaOmed Ligzos with regard to Shuma, meaning evaluating Hegdesh for purposes of Pidgin, is it Karka, is it Metaltalin? That is totally dependent upon the same issue of Karka, Metaltalin, Seir HaOmed Ligzos with regard to Me'ila in the case of an Eved. Now the Gemara says, Nema Hani Tanoi. Kehani Tanoi. The Gemara now is going to quote a brisa of Rabbi Meir, and this is in Masechta Shavuos. This is going to lead us back to the case that I referred to before about Moda B'Mitzvah Sataina. There are three categories of Shavuah Doraisa where the Torah requires a Shavuah. One of them is called Moda B'Mitzvah. And now the Gemara is going to quote a Mishnah. And that Mishnah is going to have a machlokas, again, not about Seir, but about grapes, let's say, that are ready to be cut off, harvested from the vineyard. And whether or not those grapes have the status of karka, because they're still attached to the ground, or since they're omdos likotzer, meaning they're ready for ktsira, which actually, in the case of a vineyard, the technical word is not ktsira, it's bitsira. So that's called omdos libotzer. So these grapes are fully ripened. Whether or not there would be a shvuas modu b'miktas if there was an issue back and forth about these grapes, and that should also be dependent upon our machlokes about seir haomed ligzos. So again, we're going to have two cases, and Gemara is going to assume an analogy. One case is called anovim haomdos libotzer, which are grapes that are fully ripened and are ready just to be harvested. And then we have the case of Seir HaOmed Ligzos where the hair is about to be cut off. So Nema, shall we say, Hani Tanoi, Kahani Tanoi. This machlokas Tanoim between Chachamim and Rav Shimon Gamliel with regard to Seir HaOmed Ligzos is identical with the machlokas Tanoim in the Mishnah in Masechta Shavuos between Rabbi Meir and Chachamim with regard to Anovim HaOmdos Libotzer. This Nan, the Mishnah tells us the following. Rabbi Meir Omer, Yesh Dvarim Shehein Kikarka. There are some cases where since the object is still attached to the ground, therefore it has the status of karka, and there's no shvur. V'einom Kikarka. And yet, there's still some flexibility, so to speak. There's some room for maneuverability here, and it's not completely karka. V'ein Chachamim modim lo, the Chacham rejected Rabbi Meir. Again, the Mishnah is now formulated in a very ambiguous way. We don't know what they're arguing about. What is this case that can be defined, according to Rabbi Meir, as kikarka v'eino kikarka? It's some sort of schizophrenic entity. And the Chacham say, no, it's always going to be considered karka. Ketzad, what's the case? Eser gefanim to unos means you have 10 vineyards and they're completely filled with clusters of grapes that are growing on these vines. And Reuven says to Shimon, Masarti lecha, I gave you 10 vineyards, 10 vines to watch, to be my custodian. And therefore I want you to return them to me. And if you don't return them, you have to pay me their value and compensate me. V'ala Omer, and Shimon turns to Reuven, and he says, Eino melech hamesh. I only received 5 vines from you. I did not receive 10. Which is a classic case of what, Rabosai? Modu b'miktas. Rabbi Meir mechayev. Rabbi Meir says, despite the fact that these grapes are growing in the ground, meaning that they were not yet cut off, and therefore they are mechubra lekarka, nevertheless, Rabbi Meir says, you are chayev a shvuah, modu b'miktas, because we view these grapes as mitaltalin. Chachom omrim kol ha-mechubra lekarka, reyu kikarka, as long as it hasn't been detached, it's considered karka, and therefore there's no shvuah. And in order to understand the root of this machlokas about these 10 vines, 5 of which he admits as a shomer that he owes it, and 5 he denies. And whether or not he should be chayav b'shvua, Rav Meir says he's chayav b'shvua, it's metaltalin. Chacham says he's not chayav b'shvua. We need to understand what the case is. Amar Rav Yosi, Rav Chanina, be'anovim ha'om dos li batzer askinon. The machlokas is, what's the status of these grapes if they're ready to be harvested? Everything is ready, they're ripe, we just didn't get around to it yet. They're omdos li batzer. So without reading the next line in the Gemara, let's just figure this out on our own. Let's see if we can get the mathematics here. Rabbi Meir says that you are chayav b'shvua, meaning he sees these anovim as what? Karko metaltalin. As metaltalin, otherwise there would be no shvua. Apparently he holds that since they're omdos li batzer, it's kibbutzuros dami. And that would fit in very well with the shita of Rav Shimon Gamliel in the case of Seyar of an Eved that was Hugdash, whether or not there's Me'ilah. Rav Shimon Gamliel says that Mo'alim B'Si'aro, that the Sar, the Seyar is in this case, since it's Omid Ligaz, is considered Metaltalin, and therefore there is Me'ilah. So too, Rabbi Meir holds that the Anovim Omdos Libotzer are considered as if they were already harvested, and therefore they have the status of Metaltalin Yechai B'Shvua. However, the Chachamim say that there's no Chiyuv Shvua because the Anovim, these grapes, are still attached to the Karka. You haven't yet done the actual Bitsira and harvested and detached them, and therefore they're considered like Karka. They must hold, like the Shita of the Chachamim, that if a person is Moel in the Seir, homemade Ligzos, then they hold Ein Moel in Bo, because the Seir, although it's ready to be cut down, to be, get the barber in here to cut it off, but nevertheless, it's still attached to the body, and therefore that's the din of Eved Hukish Lekarka, and there's no Me'ilah. So let's see if we got it right. Mar Sovar, Rabbi Meir holds that what? Since it's Omid Libotzer, it has a din of Metaltalin, because Kibitzuros Damyon, the Halach already views it as if it's detached, it's getting nothing from the ground. Oh yeah, and it's still attached to the ground, technically, but if you cut it off, one day later or one day earlier, it makes no difference. It's already considered as if it was cut off. It's not getting anything, benefiting in any way from the karka. And we therefore classify it as metaltalin. And if it's metaltalin, then shvuas modim mixas is generated. Umar sar, the chacham, however, hold lav kibitzuras dami. We don't view these grapes as if they were cut off, because they're still attached to the karka, and therefore we have Allah of Einish Bo'en ala karkos. So in other words, Chachamim reject the Ke'omed Svara. Rabbi Meir works with the Ke'omed Svara, and he says that Anovim Omdos Libotzer is considered as if they were cut off and they have the status of Metaltalin, and there's a Shvuas Modu Miktas. That reflects the Shita of Rav Shimon Gamliel with regard to Seyar HaOmid Ligaz Kig Gazuz Dami. So the Kig Gazuz, or the Omid Svar, means that what you anticipate, because everything is prepared, we already see it as if the reality had taken place. Whereas according to the Chachamim, both in the case of the Chachamim Rabbi Meir with regard to Shvuas Modim Miktas, the case of Anovim Omdos Libot, so they view it as Mechubel Karka Ki Karka, and therefore there's no Shavuos Modim Miktas. So too they hold in the case of Magdish Seyar HaOmed Ligazes of an Eved, there's no Din of Me'ilah, it's still considered what? Karka, it's Mechubra LeKarka, we don't use the principle of Omdos Ligazes Kigazes Domi, it's not Metaltan, it's Karka, and therefore there's no Me'ilah. So the Gemara rejects it. The Gemara says you have no right to create this interdependence between the machlokas Reb Meir and the Chachamim and the machlokas Reb Shimon Gamliel and the Chachamim. In other words, the case of Anovim Omdos Libotzer is different fundamentally than the case of Seir HaOmed Ligazes. How so? The Gemara says, lo, afilu tema Rabbi Meir, I can tell you that Rabbi Meir might agree that Seir HaOmed Ligazes is not Kigazus Domi. We don't view it as Kigazus Domi. The Adkan Loka Om Rabbi Meir Hossam, when does Rabbi Meir anticipate the future now? And he says that we can apply the principle of Omed. That's only in a negative case. What do I mean by a negative case? They're called Kamad Shavkalahu. As long as he leaves the situation as is and he doesn't cut it down, Mikhash Khashi. It robs the ground, the land, of its nutrients. Meaning, we don't want these anavim to remain attached. Because as long as he leaves the anavim without harvesting them, then the situation gets worse and worse. What does that mean? The situation deteriorates, either because it still continues to somehow damage the karka, or the anavim themselves start getting spoiled, they start getting ruined. In other words, when the moment comes in which the grapes should be cut down, if you don't cut them down at that moment, we call it the right moment, tati mashma, the right moment for cutting it down, then your anavim are going to start wilting away. They're going to start disintegrating. You'll never get the same value for your anavim that you should be getting. So in that case, we're going to apply the principle that there's no connection, so to speak. I don't mean physical, but there's no halachic connection between the anavim and the karka. And that's when Rabbi Meir came up with his shita that the anavim are viewed as metaltal, and there is a shvua, it's kir batzor dom, it's as if it's removed. Avo, but in the case of seyar, so if you don't cut the hair, kol kama deshavkalu ashbuche mishbach. If you leave the hair on the body, on the head, then kol zman, as long as he leaves it on the body, he doesn't cut it off, it even grows more and more. So again, what is the nature of continuous growth process when something is ready to be cut down? There are two possibilities. One possibility is the continued growth process is a deteriorating factor, it's a negative factor, it ruins the object. The other possibility is no, it continues to grow and grow and grow. Ultimately, the more hair you cut off, the more of a wig you can make out of it, the more value you'll get out of it. And therefore, Rabbi Meir disagrees with Rabbi Shimon Gamliel in the case of Seir Omed Ligzol something, because the longer you leave the hair growing, the more the hair grows, and it's worth more. There's a greater volume of hair to be sold on the market. Again, right now, he's going to get his money's worth, but he can get even a little bit extra money on the market. So therefore, Rabbi Meir insists that you don't apply the principle of Kegazah's dummy. When does Rabbi Meir apply the principle of Kegazah's dummy? When does he conceptually see that an object that's going to be detached is already considered detached? That's only when he works against his own best interest by leaving it and postponing the detachment, the Betzira. So this Rabosai completes a sugya that we spent about a week on of Shumas Hegdesh, and now we begin another sugya. So Rabosai, in honor of this auspicious, this beautiful occasion of starting a new sugya, we have to go back to the Mishnah. Okay. So the Mishnah, back on Daf Beis, you know, you'll see the skinny lines and then it gets wider. So we're looking in the wider lines on line 5, I believe. Let's just count together. It has Smichas Kenim, etc. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So you'll see at the end of the fifth of the wide lines, Dinei Nefashos be Esrim Ushlosha. Do you have that? Mm-hmm. Now here's where the Mishnah discusses one of the most fundamental differences between a Bezdin means a Bezdin of three, and what's called a Sanhedrin, in this case Sanhedrin Aktano, and the Sanhedrin Aktano, which is made up of 23 judges, has tremendous authority, including the authority to condemn a criminal to death. Less than 23 judges will not be sufficient in a capital case. Now the Mishnah just formulates this principle in a very general kind of way, and then it goes on to the more specifics. Now in the first specific, what we're going to talk about is putting an animal to death. Now we put an animal to death fundamentally in two cases. Again, each one of these two cases has many nuances and differences and many subcategories, but the greater categories are a shor, an animal, it doesn't have to be a shor, that was responsible for the death of a human being. Such an animal is put to death. And then we have another category, and that's what's called in English sodomy, which means if this animal was a participant in a relationship, an intimate relationship with a human being. Again, we're going to break it down into many different categories. You could have a relationship between a female animal and a male human being. You could have a relationship between a female human being and a male animal. And you can even have relationships between a male animal and a male human being. Okay, that's a different kind of approach, which we'll maybe have to talk about. So I'm just warning you, Rabbi Osei, it's a pretty gory sugya. You know, it's not aesthetically pleasing over here. But as you and I know, the Torah has to address every single situation. And the Torah is going to say, in this case of sodomy, not only do we put the human being to death, but we put the animal to death. And the question that we have here is, when we judge the animal, again, to judge the animal, it's not so easy. You're going to have two witnesses who not only saw the action, but they can identify the animal. You know, most animals look pretty similar. But I guess if you're an expert at animal breeding, or if there's a Simon Muvok on the animal, you know, it's got a red streak on its thing. Or I don't know if you ever saw, I was once in Switzerland, and if you see the cows in Switzerland, you know, they take, maybe this is true for every country in the world, you know, they take a number on a placard, and they actually stamp it down to the ear, you know, so maybe the number itself would be a way of identifying. But in any event, now we have to adduce evidence in the court in order to put this animal to death, to try the animal and adduce witnesses who will actually testify that this animal was guilty as accused. You know, for those who are in favor of animal rights, I mean, you really see how the Torah considers an animal to be something of significance. You know, who cares how many judges you have on a Beis Din to put an animal to death? But the Torah is very careful about that. And the same number of judges that takes on a court, which is called Sanhedrin Ketanim of 23, to put a human being to death, you require that for the animal. So even if, let's say, we can't put the human being to death, because, let's say, the Eidim can't identify the human being, but they can identify the animal, in such a case, to judge the animal, we need a Beis Din of 23. And now the Mishnah is going to go through these various cases. And in one of these cases, the Mishnah is going to go out of its way to quote a pasuk to try to prove that you need a Beis Din in order to put condemn the animal to death of 23 judges. So let's go through the various cases. We're going to first start with the Mishnah, and then we'll go to the Gemara Mirtz Shema Tesva. We start with Haroveya. Roveya is a case, and it probably, if somebody could be my sofer, my scribe, just to commit this to writing, because sometimes the language of the Mishnah gets a little confusing to us. So there's something called a Roveya. That's referring to a shor, who is the active agent in a sodomy relationship with a woman. And halacha is, as we'll see in the Torah, that not only is she put to death, meaning the victim, I don't know what you call it, the recipient, I don't know what to call her, but she's on the receiving end of this revia, and she's put to death, assuming that we have all the conditions necessary to condemn someone to death, but the roveya is also put to death. That's going to require the same 23 judges that we require in order to put her to death. That's the case of Roveya. Now we move on to the case of Nirva. Nirva is a case of a female animal who was the recipient of a sodomy relationship with a man. The man is going to be put to death, and the animal is also to be put to death. Now the Mishnah is going to establish that in both cases of a Roveya and a Nirva, both referring to the animal, be Esrim Ushlosha. We need 23 judges in order to condemn the animal to death. So it makes no difference, says the Mishnah, whether or not the Shor is the active agent in the case of Roveya Habal Isha, or the Shor is the passive in the case of a female Shor, the passive recipient of Revia, which means the shor is called a nirva. Nirva is in the nifal. Nifal means it was done to the object, correct? So there's the Roveya and the Nirva. In both cases, the Mishnah establishes Bi Esrim Bushlosha. Less than 23 judges would not suffice. Shenemar. Now we have to know where the main parsha of Revia is, because we're going to soon see that there's another parsha in a different one of the five books, and that the Gemara is going to always constantly go back to these two parshios. So it pays up front to make note of the fact that we're now in Parshas Kedoshim in Sefer Vayikra, and it says there, V'harakta es ha'isha v'es ha'behema. Notice that the Torah not only metes out a death penalty to both the woman, again we're talking about a Roveah and the Roveah the animal, but more than that, they're both brought in the same breath in one pasuk. What's that called? Anybody remember what that's called when you have two different laws that are brought in the same verse or one next to the other? Hekesh. Excellent. So we have a Hekesh now, which is an analogy, an equation between the death of the woman and the death of the animal. And this proves that just like the death of the woman is contingent on a bezdin of 23 judges, so too the death of the animal needs a bezdin of 23 judges. Fine. The Omer, in that very same context, it says the following. I'll read the entire pasuk. It says, "V'ish asher yitein shchavto bebehema mos yumas v'sabehema tarogu." Now we have the case not of a shor haroveya, but rather of a shor nirva, because the Torah starts by saying, "Ish asher yitein shchavto bebehema." In other words, the man is now the active agent, and the female animal is the recipient. And the Torah says, "The es." Most you must, meaning he's put to death. He's called the Roveya in this case, right? And the Nirvat, meaning the animal, that's a behemoth rogu. And once again, because it's written in the same pasuk, we conclude that just like the man who is the Roveya of the animal, he's the active agent, he has to be put to death in nothing less than a court that's made up of 23 judges, so too when it says v'es ha-behemet ha-rogu, that the animal who's a nirva is the passive recipient, has to be put to death in the same judgment, in the same level of a court as that which condemns a man, the rovea, to death, and you need 23 judges. So Rav Osai, what we have now are two cases of rovea and nirva. Now we haven't yet addressed another case, and that's going to be the Sugyas HaGemara that we want to talk about, and that's going to be a case where a man, a human male, was the recipient of a revia of an animal. Now, the animal is a male, and it has this sodomous relationship with a male. Does everybody have that? Do I have to go into details about that, or you can figure that out on your own? Okay. So that's going to be the sugya of the Gemara. Fine. Now we turn backwards, we rewind to Sefer Shmos. Here's another case where a shor is put to death, an animal is put to death, not for a revia situation, but rather for a hariga situation. I use the word hariga as opposed to ritzicha, because when you talk about a human being committing murder, that word is ritzicha, lo tirzach. But when you talk about an animal who put a human being to death, that's called hariga. And what is the punishment meted out to an animal that is responsible for the death of a human being? The punishment is skila. So we take the animal and we push it off a high cliff. How many judges do we need to condemn the shor for skila? Be esrim ushlosha. Shenemar, now we have to go back to the parish of Shor Niskal, Shor Shorges HaAdam, and that parish is in Sefer Shmos, in the parish of Mishpatim, and it says there, Ashor Yisakel, that if a shor kills a human being, it should be stoned. V'gam ba'ol of Yumas, which literally means that the owner of the shor should die. And the Gemara, let's start with the Mishnah, and then the Gemara is going to analyze this. But the Mishnah assumes that we can't take this pasuk kipshuto v'gamba ol of yumas. And again, we're going to have a whole sugya to try to prove why it's impossible to tolerate a literal translation of v'gamba ol of yumas. There's no way we can put the owner of the shor to death. It doesn't make any sense, and we're going to prove that. But assuming that Vagam Bala Vyumas does not mean what it says, so what is it coming to tell us? And the answer is, it's coming to shed a light on the Skilas Hashor. Interesting. The Torah adds Vagam Bala Vyumas to set up an equation between the way that we can condemn the requirements that we must be met to put a shor to death, and the requirements that we have to put a human being to death. Not in this case. Again, keep in mind, Rabosai, the reason that we can derive conclusions here and set up an analogy between shor haniskal and misas bailim, in a case where we put a person to death, is because of the fact that gamba ol of yumas cannot be taken literally, translated as if it says that we put the owner of the shor to death, but rather it's here only to create some sort of concept, which is a theoretical concept up in the conceptual world, called misas habaylim. Misas habaylim means in other cases, right? We have many sins, many criminal acts, which generate a chiyuv misa. And whenever that applies, and we put a person to death, we need a judgment of 23 judges. Now the Torah is telling me, in the case of shor haniskal, we should equate the process by which we condemn the shor to death to the case of condemning a human being to death. Not again in this case, but rather in another case. And that's called kemisas habaylim kach misas hashor. Just like we can only put a person, a human being, to death if he was condemned by a judgment of 23 judges, so too we can only put the shor to death when it killed a human being if the case is tried by a bezdin of 23 judges. So that's what we have to know in the Mishnah itself. Let's just make a note of where we got to in the Mishnah, because we're hopefully very quickly going to get back to the Mishnah, and then we're going to talk about shor haniskal in greater detail. The Mishnah goes into detail about what animals are so ferocious and so belligerent that we have to put them to death because they are man-killing animals. So that's going to be the next part of the Mishnah. So we'll say now we're on Daf Tesvav Amud Aleph, and we're up to the Gemara that says Dine Nefashos Vechule, etc. So let's just see again, we decided that this part of the Mishnah is towards the bottom of the Amud. Let's count up from the bottom. How many? 12 lines?
11
lines up from the bottom.
It starts 12, yeah.
And it starts with Dini Nefashos.
That's 12 lines.
Right. So we have Dini Nefashos. And then he writes Chule. Chule means he assumes that you know the rest of the Mishnah. Okay, let me say a few words about the next three words in the Gemara, because these three words are almost a methodological principle, which you'll see over and over again throughout Shas. You know my style. I like to point these things out to you because the shir is not only about Masechta Sanhedrin, but it's about how to learn a piece of Gemara. So these three words, which are called Kaposik Vitani, if you did a word search, you know, you take Bar Ilan and you punch in Kaposik Vitani, you'll probably find hundreds of entries all over Shas of Kaposik Vitani. So we'll first translate these words literally, and then we'll translate them conceptually in terms of a conceptual methodology that applies all over Shas. Literally, it means he gave a psak, Vitani, and he formulated it in a Mishnah. Usually the word Tana or Tani refers to a Mishnah. Sometimes it can refer to a Braisa. And Pasik means he gave a ruling. However, although that's the literal translation of these three words, but the meaning of these words is what I call the rule of unqualified is unqualified. Meaning, if the Tana says something without qualifying, then we assume that it always applies in every case. Meaning there's going to be one case which maybe logically we would have thought, and the thought would have crossed our minds as a habamita, that the rule would not apply. But from the fact that the Mishnah issued its verdict and formulated the law without qualifying it, it means even in that case it's going to apply. So what now is the chiddush of the Mishnah when the Mishnah speaks about a shor haroveya? Now again, a shor haroveya, the Mishnah establishes, requires a Beis Din of 23 judges to condemn the Shar to death. The Shar Roveh, as we said when we learned the Mishnah, if you recall a few minutes ago, was a Zachar that was Roveh and a Keva, a female human being. What about the case of a Shar, a male animal, that was Roveh, a male human being? Which is a very unusual, I mean, again, sodomy in general, I hope, is kind of unusual, right? That itself is kind of that's a deviation from normal human behavior, and probably even from animal behavior. But the most, perhaps, extreme, weird case, unusual case of a revia with an animal is Rovea Zachar, where the Shar is having a sodomous relationship with a male. I mean, that's like doubly strange. It's a homosexual sodomy. You know what I'm saying? It's like Tarti L'Reisa. But the Mishnah doesn't make any distinction. So the Gemara says the following. Kaposik v'toni, loshna, it makes no difference whether it's Rovea Zachar, loshna Rovea Nekeva, whether it's Rovea Nekeva, meaning, who is the human recipient of this revia, where the animal is the roveh, is the active element? It doesn't matter whether it's a male or a female. And in both cases, you're going to require 23 judges to put the shar to death. Says the Gemara, Bishleima roveh nekeva, if we have an animal that's actively involved in this revia with a nekeva, the nekeva is the recipient. Well, that's explicit in the Torah. The Torah says the ksiv, going back to the part of the pasuk that we mentioned in our Mishnah, it says that we're going to put the woman and the animal to death. So the animal is the roveah, the woman is the nirva, and there's an absolute hekesh in one phrase, in one breath. The Mishnah equates the isha the behemah, and that's going to teach us that you need 23 judges, just like you need 23 judges to put her to death, you need 23 judges to put him to death. Him being the animal, the roveh. El roveh zachar minolan. But how did the Mishnah know that in this very, very strange scenario, very strange case, where the animal is roveh, a male human being, there too, we need to judge the animal in front of a Beis Din of 23 judges? Now again, go ahead.
For a kal v'chomer?
Oh, excellent. So you might have said, maybe it's a kal v'chomer. You know, the shar here is even more guilty, so to speak, of some sort of what word am I looking for? An aberration, a phenomenon that's so sick. Then for sure the shar is sicker. Right. It's even sicker. So if it's even sicker, today, you know, they use the word sick in many different ways, but my day, sicker meant sicker. Right? You know, say? So the Gemara thinks the following. You know what? Maybe in this case, you know, the Shar is so guilty here of doing this kind of an action. You know, it's bad enough if the Shar, so to speak, victimizes a woman, but now it's victimizing a man. Maybe in such a case, this Shar has to be put to death, you know, pronto, ASAP. You know, let's not wait for 23 judges. I don't know. But just on a technical level, the Torah has to teach us this halacha. We don't have rights to extrapolate and derive conclusions. If the Torah went out of its way to create a hekesh between the animal that's a roveh and the woman who's the nirvas, and that's in the pasuk that says ve'aragta esha ves habema, then we have no right to assume ve'aragta esha ish ves habema in a case where the shor was a roveh zachar. So again, we're going to soon see that when it comes to a male human being the active agent, if you will, in the act of sodomy with a female animal, then the Torah is going to tell us explicitly that we put to death both the male human being, who's the rovea, and the animal, who's the female nirva. So that we know. But we don't know anywhere in the Torah, in the case where the animal is the roveh, the male animal, and the nirva is the male human being. That's a very freaky case. Where does the Torah address that case to teach us that likewise it requires a Beis Din of 23 judges? And again, we go back to the principle of kaposik v'tani, the fact that the Mishnah says in all cases of revia, if the shor is a roveh, we put the shor to death with 23 judges. apparently, if you're talking in general cases of all Roveya, you have a general all-inclusive principle, then even in the case of a Shah that was Roveya Zachar, we would put the Shah to death, but only in front of a Bezdin of 23 judges. How do you know such a thing? What's the source for that? So the Gemara now quotes the same parasha that we mentioned earlier in Mishpatim. Now, what does it say in Parshas Mishpatim? It says, "Kol shochev im behema mos yumas." Now, clearly, shochev im behema. Who is the roveya here? Who's the active agent? Shochev im behema. He sleeps with an animal.
The man.
The man. Oh, so l'chora, this is not going to help us at all. We're looking for a case of a roveya when the animal is the active agent. So here the Gemara is going to apply the principle of im eino inyan. Let's say a few words about im eino inyan. It's also a methodological principle that appears all over Shas. What the Gemara is going to do now is going to take two parashios. You remember we started with the parasha in Vayikra Perek Chof, and now we have a parasha in Shmos Perek Chof Beis, and we're going to see that the Torah is repeating what we already know. And this repetition, you know, begs us to try to analyze why the Torah would bother repeating itself. And in such a case, we use a principle called im eino inyan, that if we can't use it for any purpose in its context, then we have to take it out of context and put it into a larger or broader context. So let's take a look. There are two psukim now that seem to repeat the same halacha, the same halachic principle. One is in Shmos. There it says, "Kol shochev im behema mos yumas." And this indicates that if a man is the active agent in a revia, so he's the roveya, he was roveya an animal, and the Torah says that we have to put him to death and the animal to death. Well, in truth, in Parshas Kedoshim, the Torah repeats the same idea, that if the man is a roveya an animal, you put them both to death. The Torah says, and I quote, "V'ish asher yitein shchavto b'behema mos yumas v'esa behema tarogu." So the Torah is already outspoken. It says it black on white explicitly that if a man is a roveh of an animal, he will die and the animal also will die. So why do we need the pasuk in Shmos, "Kol shochev im behema mos yumas"? We know that "ish asher yitein shchavto b'behema mos yumas." So why the repetition? So again, Rabbi said, just to summarize, the Torah tells us that the Roveya has to be put to death when he is a human being, a male who has this relationship with an animal. And the Torah repeats itself again in Vayikra. So we start with Shmos and we go to Vayikra. And when we compare them, the Torah is repeating the same thing twice. So therefore we apply the principle of im eino inyan, that the Torah repeats it to broaden the category, to include something which you and I wouldn't have anticipated would be included. Tneu le'inyan le'nishkav. You must use it for a case where the man is the nirva, right? He's the passive recipient, so to speak. And the Torah is telling us that in this case, like in the case where the man is the active agent, we put both him to death and the shah. So again, it's a case of a shar that has this relationship with a male, a human male. And how do I know the Torah is referring to that when it says, "Vesa beima tarogu"? And not only does the man get put to the human being, but also the animal gets put to death. I know it through the principle called im eino inyan, because the Torah repeats this twice. Let's go over the psukim. In Shmos it says, "Kol shochev im behema mos yumas." And in Vayikra Perkov it says, "V'ish asher yitein shchavto b'beima mos yumas v'esa beima tarogu." So why would the Torah in two cases, in two psukim, in two parts of the Torah, repeat the fact that if a man has this relationship with an animal, then we put the man to death and the animal as well? And the answer is, the Torah wants to give us a ribui here, that's called tneu, for the case where the man is not the active agent, he's not the roveya, but rather he's the nirva, he's the nishkav. So now when we read the pasuk that says, "Kol shochev im behema mos yumas," we're going to interpret this as referring not just to a case where the behema is the passive recipient, but even if the behema is the active roveah. But that's very strange, because the Torah used the term shochev, and the Torah is addressing the human being. Kol shochev im behema mos yumas. So the Gemara answers, the afke rachmona b'loshen shochev. The Torah was motzi, meaning it took it, afke means to take it out, right? Afke. And it takes it out of its mouth, so to speak, meaning it formulates it. B'loshen shochev. Why did the Torah go out of its way to refer to a nishkav and call him a shochev? Lakushe nishkav l'shochev. In order to impress upon us an analogy between the nishkav and the shochev. And what does that mean? That just like in the case of the shochev, the Torah says explicitly, not once but twice, that we put him and the animal to death. So too, in the case of a nishkav, where the man is the recipient and the animal is the active agent, and he's a male, nevertheless, we have the same din, which means that we have to put him to death, and the shor has to be put to death in a beis din of 23 judges. Ma shochev hu behemto b'esrim v'shlosha ha'nishkav is hu behemto b'esrim u'shlosha. Just like the Torah says explicitly that we have an equation between the behema, which is a rovea, and the person who's the nishkav. So too, if the let me say it a little bit differently. Just like we find in the case of a man who's the active agent and he's a shochev in behema, that we put both the man and the behema to death in front of the same court, the high court of 23 judges, so too in a case where the animal is the shochev and the man is the nishkav, and in this case again we're talking about a male, we require an equation to the Adam, and the Adam is put to death in front of 23, and so is the Shoch.
Is the Shochev then the passive?
No, the Shochev is the active, and the Nishkav is the passive. So we're saying the following. In Shochev, the Torah went out of its way to say that the man and the animal have to be killed with the same requirements of 23 judges. That's the Shochev case. And the Torah actually says that not once, but twice. And the extra time is coming to tell you that even if he is the nishkav, which means he's the passive recipient of the revia of the animal, the same law applies, and the same equation between the misas bailim and the misas shor requiring 23 judges applies. We go on in the Mishnah, and the Mishnah says that we derive from a pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim that a shor that killed a human being has to be put to death with skilith in front, if it's condemned in front of a basin of 23 judges, because the Torah says, Vashar Yisakel, we stone the shor that killed a human being. We'll call it a killer shor. V'gamba ol of Yumas. And what does it mean, Gamba ol of Yumas? With the Bailam have to be put to death. What does that mean? It means that just like a human being, in order to be condemned to death, we need the presence of a court that's made up of 23 judges. So too, the death of the shor could only be implemented by a beis din that presides over the court, and that beis din is comprised of how many judges? 23 judges. That's called kemisas habailim kach misas hashor. But again, be careful here, Rabbo. So, you know, it's easy to fall into a pit. Make a big mistake. Misas Habayim doesn't mean in this particular case. In this case, there is no Misas Habayim, which is going to be the subject of our sugya here. We're not going to put a person to death if he was careless and he didn't watch his animal, a belligerent shor mu'ad, and the animal went out and killed somebody. Again, if you ask me, we should put him to death. But the Torah was lenient with him, and Torah says v'gamba ol of yumas, which is some sort of divine. You know, God will know how to square it up in Shemayim, and the words "v'gambal of Yumas" now are taken to shed a light on Shor Yisakel. That just like Baal of Yumas in another case, not this case, where the man was responsible for a capital crime, and the law is that he can only be judged in front of a bench of 23 judges. So too, in the case of the Shor Niskal needs a beis din of 23 judges. And at this point, we're going to turn to Daf Tesvav Amud Beis. So the Gemara is not happy with this drasha. Amalei Abaye LeRava. I jumped the gun a little bit. The high mimai. How do you know the high that this pasuk? It says Hashor Yisakel Gambal of Yumas. That's going to teach us this equation, this analogy between Mises Abayim Kach Mises Hashor Hu Dios. So that's what it's coming for. But rather, Emolik Tola Hu Dios. Maybe the Torah, in fact, is telling me that the owner of the shor has to be put to death. Now, if you're building yourself, your argument on the extra superfluous words for Gambal of Yumas, because you're assuming, no, the Torah could not possibly mean that we kill the owner of the shor. That doesn't make any sense. He's not a murderer. And therefore, the Gambal of Yumas remains a mystery. What is the Torah telling me, the Gambal of Yumas, if he's not going to be put to death? It must be that the Torah is telling me something to shed a light on the Shor HaNiskal, that the Shor HaNiskal, like a case of Gambal of Yumas, not in this particular case, as I emphasized a million times, but in general, in another case where a person is condemned by the court to capital punishment, the court has to be made up of 23 judges. So too, the Shor HaNiskal could only be determined and established as the Shor HaNiskal in the presence of a Beis Din of 23 judges. So the Gemara says, Emolik Tolu Dios. Abaye is not happy because he says that, you know, you're assuming that the pasuk here is superfluous. Well, that Gambal of Yumas cannot be interpreted kipshuto literally. And therefore you want to use it to shed a light on Shor Yisakel and talk about a general condemnation of a person for death, which requires the decision of a 23 judge panel. Maybe l'ktolahu dios. So Rabbosei, say, imagine what's going on over here. You know, my Rebbe always taught us to take a Havamina seriously. This is a pretty wild Havamina. That Gambal of Yuma should be taken literally, and that the owner of the shor should be put to death. Why? Because he was negligent, and he allowed the shor to go unfettered, and the shor never killed a human being. Okay, I understand there's a pshia here, and believe me, I'm the first one to stand online and tar and feather this guy. I mean, he should really be strung up from his toes, upside down. But nevertheless, he didn't kill anybody. I mean, did he know that the shor was going to go and kill someone? Maybe he should have known that that's going to happen, because this shor is a very dangerous shor. By the way, I'm just on the side. Does anybody know the halachic status of a bull in a bullfight? Would he be put to death if he if he kills a human being?
No.
Yeah, why not? Do you remember that? You learned about the Kalman, so
it's a svara. I mean,
oh, you're saying it's svara. Well, the Gemara calls it shor itztadion, which like is a shor that they, you know, the Romans used to put out in their stadium,
yeah.
And we have bullfights. It's amazing that Rome is still alive and well. In fact, in Spain, I was told that after the bullfight, they let the bull go through the streets. And people die. I mean, it's just a sick society. It's, you know, it's not a pillar that we look at the Western world that we see the cruelty of the Western world, the hypocrisy of the Western world. Anyway, so the halacha is that if the shor is trained to be a killer, it's not naturally a killer. The Gemara is especially alfusa to prove that such a shor is not put to death. Which, by the way, leads to many different possible conclusions about why the Torah says you put the shor to death. The Ramban assumes that the reason you put the shor to death is a punishment for the animal, which is a pilly plum that an animal is punished for its crimes. I mean, we don't believe that an animal has freedom of choice. But the Ramban thinks that an animal has a seichel, not maybe it's not as developed as the intellect of a human being, and the animal could also be, so to speak, guilty, again I say this with inverted commas, to such an extent that the animal has to be punished. But if the animal is trained to be a killer animal, you know, for a bullfight, that's not called a shor niskal. Oh yeah, I'm just saying that on the side. I was always fascinated by that halacha. So the Gemara wants to assume that maybe the owner of the shor should be put to death. So the Gemara says, in Cain, if you are correct that the Torah is just coming to teach us that just like the shor is put to death, the owner of the shor should be put to death, is lichtov that the Torah could have said, and I'm going to read the whole pasuk, Hashor Yisakel v'gam v'olav. Because v'gam v'olav would mean that just like the shor is going to be stoned, so to the owner of the shor, the human being, will be stoned. V'lishtok, and he could have been quiet, meaning he didn't have to add the extra word yumas. So the word yumas is superfluous. We thought that the whole pasuk of v'gam v'olav yumas is, that whole phrase of three words, is ibrik, is superfluous, unnecessary. Well, we need two other words, according to Yahav, because v'gam v'olav is going to teach me that just like the shor is put to death by stoning, we have to put the owner of the shor to death by stoning. Unbelievable how the Gemara takes this Hav Amina so seriously, that we have to put the owner of the shor to death. But v'lishtok, the Torah didn't have to add the word yumas. You know, it's based on the laws of grammar and the laws of interpreting words in the Torah. Even in the absence of the word yumas, we would understand that the Torah is telling us, the v'gam goes back to the beginning of the pasuk, which says the shor has to be put to death, v'gam, and so too the owner of the shor has to be put to death. But it didn't have to spell out that he had to be put to death by saying yumas, and therefore we're going to use that extra word yumas for this hekesh, to teach me yumas, meaning that there's this paradigm case of miso, which is the case of a human being who is condemned to death, and now the shor is going to be equated with that paradigm case of yumas, of a man being put to death, meaning that you require a bezdin of 23 judges. So the Gemara now asks the question that we've been asking over and over again. Are you serious? That's how I doesn't say that in the Gemara, but that's what I'm adding. Are you actually, do I take you at face value? Are you telling me that the Torah should have said Shor Yisakel v'gam v'olav, right? And what do you mean v'gam v'olav? That we put the owner of the shor to death? Ikase Rachmana Hachi. If the Torah would say that, Hava Mina, I would accept your Hava Mina b'skila, that we take the owner of the shor and we put him to death. B'skila salkedaitach. Is that a valid Hava Mina? That you want to suggest that when it says v'gam ba'olav, it means that we actually take the owner of the shor, push him off a high cliff until he dies. Katal iu, if he had murdered someone, besides, okay, the halacha is that a person who commits murder is beheaded in a nice kind of a way, but in the different ways in which we try to minimize the gory parts of it and the pain of it, so forth, so on. But anyway, He's put to death with Saif. Now, Saif is a pretty serious kind of death penalty, but it's relatively quick and easy, if you follow me. You know, pretty much you die instantaneously. There's a much more severe kind of death if you're thrown off a cliff because you bounced around on the bottom of the cliff until you finally die. And if you don't die, they'll add stones from the top until you finally crush to death. But that's not pleasant at all. I mean, no death is too pleasant, but as deaths go, Saif is a more pleasant death. So now you're telling me the following. A murderer is put to death by Saif, by decapitation. And now you're going to tell me Mamono, but if he's not a murderer, but rather his animal, his possession, killed someone, Beskila, he gets the most severe of all the punishments of death. You know, it's interesting that Allah takes the four categories of death very seriously. You know, you and I might have said cynically, what's the difference? In the long run, you're dead anyway, so who cares? No, but the Torah cares about that. And there's a whole system of gradations and a pyramid of different punishments. And the more severe death penalty is skila. So now you're telling me that we're going to put a man who's shark killed someone to death with skila? Had he taken an arrow and shot it in the guy's heart and killed him directly, he would only be chayev sayif. And this is sugya later on in Sanhedrin that derives that a rotzeach is chayev sayif. So the Gemara says, Dilma hay dekos rachmona yumas la kule iluye. What does it mean, la kule iluye? There are various punishments. There's Saif, which is relatively instantaneous, it's easy. There's Skila, which is the most perhaps profound and painful death. And in the middle we have something called Chenek. Chenek means when we make sure that he can't breathe and he dies from lack of oxygen. So the Gemara is suggesting that Eino Chinami, we should put the owner of the shard to death. But when the Torah says Vegam Bi Olav, it means a lower death. And that means Lafuki Misayef Lechenek. We're going to take him down one notch from decapitation down to Chenek, strangulation. Again, we don't actually strangle him. There's a whole Mishnah later on in Perikei Elohim and Nechnok about how we actually do that, but I'm going to leave that out for now. So Lafuki Misayef Lechenek. It means that Chenek is more chamur, is more severe than Sayif. And what the Torah wants to tell us is that we give him Sayif, and you might ask, well, how can we do so? And the answer is we're equating him with a murderer. So what's the law in the case of a murderer? Somebody who actively kills another human being? No, Saif. He gets Saif. Rotzek gets Saif. Now in this case that he's guilty for not watching his shor, we're going to also apply the principle of Misaso B'Saif. And when the Pasuk says V'gam Ba'olav, it means we're going to lower him from the Misa of the Shard, because the Misa of the Shard is Skila, that's the most severe of all the Misos, down to the level of Saif. Just one second. Dilma, hi the Kos Rahmana Yumas, La Kule Uluye, right, to take him down, La Foke Misayef Lechenek. So Chenek, as I told you before, is more chamur. Chenek is more chamur than Saif. Slahoti misa Saif misa. Okay. Ah, I see. So again, if he would have committed direct murder, then he'd be chayv misa Saif. But in the case of a shor, what we're doing is we're being compassionate. We're saying the owner of the shor is not going to be chayv Saif, but instead he'll be chayv chenek. So now the Gemara is assuming. Just one second. So, well, let me just read the next line of the Gemara. Just make sure I got the mathematics straight. Hani cholamanti omar chenek chamur. So, if I assume that chenek is more severe than saif, because again, saif is instantaneous. So it means that if his shor kills a human being, then what? Then the Torah is telling us that what? Honicha lemadi omar chenek chamur. Lemadi omar chenek kal mai ikal meimar. I see, Rav Osei, it's very late. So there's a little bit of mathematics here, which I don't want to take another 15 minutes of time. We'll stop here, Mir Tzashem, and we'll pick this up tomorrow. Okay, then? Now, as far as the Iyun Shir is concerned, I always forget. Mitch, you're available on Tuesday, you said, right? Yeah. Yes, I don't know. You might be available on Monday.
I might be available on Monday.
You might be available Monday. You don't know.
Say, I could be available on Monday.
Yeah, you might be available on Monday as well. I'm not just saying that.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have two people for Monday. Let's just see who else is here. Jerry is not around. He usually participates. And Jonathan Bloomberg participates. I'll try to get you an answer sometime today. All right, then? Everyone should have a great day.
My wife goes to a shiur on Sunday mornings.
So Sunday is good for you.